This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
It's not every day you see a legal slap fight break out over something as dry as a deadline extension, but leave it to the Alex Murdaugh case to turn even that into a high-stakes drama. It all came to a head in early April 2025, when the South Carolina Supreme Court quietly issued a ruling that packed more weight than its brief language suggested. The court granted the state's request for more time to respond to Murdaugh's appeal, not just a little bit more, but an extra 120 days on top of the 90 they'd already had. That moves their deadline out to August 8th, 2025. It was a procedural ruling on paper, but behind the scenes it revealed a much deeper tug of war over control, perception, and momentum in one of the most watched post-conviction appeals in recent memory. Now let's be clear, the state of South Carolina, led by Attorney General Alan Wilson, didn't just wake up late and ask for a do-over. Their official reasoning boiled down to what they called extraordinary circumstances. And to be fair, this case isn't your standard run-of-the-mill appeal. The trial record alone is a monster. Over 6,000 pages of transcripts from weeks of testimony, plus exhibits, hearing records, video, forensics, you name it. The kind of thing you don't exactly knock out with a cup of coffee and a weekend of reading. The state also pointed to internal reshuffling. The appellate team had been reorganized. New attorneys were brought in to take over the appeal, and those lawyers needed time to get up to speed. On top of that, the Attorney General's office mentioned they were juggling other major cases, some involving the death penalty, which added more weight to their claim that this wasn't just procrastination. It was a resource issue. But Murdaugh's defense team didn't buy it. Not even a little. In fact, their response to the extension request landed with all the subtlety of a thrown brick. They fired back immediately, arguing that the prosecutors had already had plenty of time, nearly a year, in fact. They pointed to the fact that the jury tampering allegations, which form a major part of the appeal, had been filed back in August 2024. And even the formal 121-page appeal brief was submitted in December. From their perspective, the state knew what was coming and had months to prepare. Then there was the transcript issue. The defense pointed to records showing the state didn't even request certain transcripts from the trial until March 31st, 2025, a mere 10 days before their response was originally due. To the defense, that looked less like a team buried in work and more like one that hadn't started their homework until the night before it was due. They accused the AG's office of dragging its feet, only realizing at the last second that they were underprepared and now trying to buy themselves more time under the cover of bureaucratic overload. And they didn't stop there. The defense reminded the court that the Attorney General's office isn't exactly a mom-and-pop operation. It's home to nearly 90 attorneys across the state. If those resources aren't enough to respond to an appeal in the most high-profile case the state has prosecuted in decades, then, according to the defense, maybe the problem is more about priorities than workload. Their filing came off like a polite throat clear with a dagger behind it. If you can't get it done, maybe find someone who can. This wasn't just legal snark, though. The defense argued that the delay wasn't harmless. Every day this appeal drags on, Alex Murdaugh remains a convicted double murderer without a final ruling on whether his trial was fair. From their point of view, justice delayed is justice denied. And they weren't afraid to say it outright. They even went so far as to suggest that the state was unlikely to prevail in the appeal at all, and that the delay only served to prolong an unjust outcome. In short, both sides were throwing punches, but what made this moment so unusual is that they were doing it in public. Legal disputes over appeal timelines are usually mundane. Extensions are common, especially in complex cases, and they're typically granted without much fuss. But here, the courtroom tension spilled out into court filings that sounded more like campaign speeches. It wasn't just about extra time. It was about who gets to control the tempo and the narrative as this appeal unfolds. That's what made the Supreme Court's decision so interesting. The order itself was short, just a few lines confirming the new deadline, but its subtext was loud. The justices, by granting the request, essentially signaled that they're willing to let this case breathe. They're not rushing. They want it done right. That might frustrate the defense, but it also means the court is treating the case with the caution it demands, given everything that's already happened, the media circus, the jury tampering allegations, and the long shadow this case continues to cast over South Carolina's legal system. And make no mistake, the stakes are still massive. This isn't just about whether Alec Murdaugh walks free. It's about whether the original trial, televised, sensationalized, and dissected by every armchair analyst with a Wi-Fi signal, was legally clean. The longer this appeal drags out, the more time both sides have to frame the story. For the state, the delay gives them space to thoroughly rebut claims of jury tampering and defend Judge Newman's evidentiary rulings. For the defense, it's another opportunity to emphasize the urgency of a case they claim was corrupted from the inside by a clerk allegedly chasing fame and book deals. So now the clock resets. The state has until August 8, 2025 to file its response, and from there we're looking at a late 2025 or early 2026 window for oral arguments, maybe later. In the meantime, both sides are sharpening their blades. The state gets its second wind. The defense gets more time to remind the world of what they see as a broken trial. And the South Carolina Supreme Court. They get to keep holding the most radioactive case in the state's modern history right in their hands. If you want to understand the core of Alec Murdaugh's appeal, you have to strip away all the noise, the documentaries, the Dateline specials, the courtroom memes, and get down to the filing that hit the South Carolina Supreme Court in December 2024. It was 121 pages long, meticulous in tone, and surgical in intent. This wasn't a desperate shot in the dark. It was a calculated roadmap of exactly how and why Murdaugh's defense team believes his conviction wasn't just flawed, it was legally unsound. At the heart of the appeal is a name that's become almost as controversial as Murdaugh's, Rebecca Becky Hill, the court clerk, the woman who managed jury logistics during the trial, the same woman who, according to the defense, didn't just cross a line, she allegedly bulldozed through it. The defense claims that Hill's actions amounted to jury tampering, and they're not being subtle about it. They allege that during the trial, Hill told jurors not to be fooled by Murdaugh's testimony, that she made comments suggesting he was lying on the stand, that she encouraged jurors to deliberate quickly, possibly to meet media deadlines or for the sake of public optics, and perhaps most eyebrow-raising of all, they point to the fact that she published a book about the trial shortly after the verdict. A book that paints her as a small-town hero navigating the biggest case the Lowcountry had ever seen. The implication from the defense? That she was playing to the cameras and possibly pushing the jury to do the same? But here's the kicker. The judge who oversaw the post-trial hearing, former South Carolina Chief Justice Jean Toll, didn't entirely dismiss these claims. In fact, she went on record saying that Becky Hill was not credible, that her conduct was highly inappropriate, that she appeared to have been influenced by the idea of fame. And yet Toll denied the motion for a new trial anyway. Her rationale was that despite Hill's behavior, the defense hadn't proven that her actions actually influenced the jury's decision. In legal terms, that's the difference between misconduct and reversible misconduct. Murdaugh's lawyers weren't satisfied. In the December appeal, they doubled down. They argued that the very nature of Hill's alleged interference compromised the jury's independence. That a fair trial means more than just a clean verdict. It means a process that's untouched by outside influence. And if the court clerk herself was pushing the scale behind the scenes even slightly, that's not a fair trial. It's theater. But the appeal doesn't stop with Becky Hill. That's just the headline. The deeper content of the brief gets into what lawyers call cumulative error, meaning that even if each individual issue isn't enough to toss the verdict, the combined weight of them might be. Think of it like this. One leak in a boat isn't great, but a dozen small leaks? That's going to sink something. One of the biggest leaks the defense points to is the inclusion of Murdaugh's financial crimes during the murder trial. Now, Murdaugh has already admitted to stealing millions of dollars from clients in his former law firm. He's pleaded guilty in both state and federal court, but the question raised in the appeal is whether all of that should have been part of the murder trial at all. Judge Clifton Newman allowed prosecutors to present detailed testimony about Murdaugh's financial misdeeds. The prosecution argued it went to motive, that Murdaugh was in a financial death spiral and killed his wife and son to distract from the unraveling of his secret life. The defense, on the other hand, says that was pure character assassination. They argue that the financial testimony served to make the jury despise Murdaugh before they even got to the murder charges, that it painted him not just as flawed, but as monstrous, and that no fair jury could look past that avalanche of unrelated fraud to assess the murder evidence objectively. This isn't a new legal debate. Courts often have to decide when bad behavior is relevant and when it's just prejudicial. The defense argues that in this case, the scale tipped too far, that the jury got lost in tales of missing millions, opioid addiction, and betrayed friends, and that those details blurred the line between a motive theory and a smear campaign. There's also the issue of forensic evidence. The appeal challenges how certain evidence was presented and whether key details were misrepresented or overemphasized. This includes things like ballistics, matching shell casings to weapons, and digital forensics like cell phone data placing Murdaugh near the crime scene. The defense claims that some of the expert testimony overstated certainty or leaned on methods that lacked scientific rigor. While these aren't headline-grabbing arguments, they're strategically important because if an appellate court finds that the jury was misled or misinformed by expert testimony, even in part, that opens the door to questioning the entire verdict. Another point raised in the appeal is the exclusion of defense witnesses. During the trial, Murdaugh's team attempted to call certain individuals to testify on his behalf, some about his character, others to refute prosecution timelines or evidence. According to the appeal, the court limited or outright blocked this testimony. The defense argues that this hamstrung their ability to present a complete narrative. They say jurors didn't get the full picture, and that's not how the system is supposed to work. There's also mention of how the media circus surrounding the case might have influenced proceedings. While the appeal doesn't hinge on this, it does suggest that the courtroom atmosphere was charged with pressure, attention, and spectacle. That's important context when paired with the Becky Hill allegations, as it paints a picture of a trial that was not just public, but potentially performative. At the core of all of this is one legal principle: structural fairness. The defense doesn't have to prove that Alec Murdaugh is innocent. They don't even have to prove that a different jury would have acquitted him. What they're arguing is that the structure of the trial, the foundation it was built on, was compromised, and that under the U.S. and South Carolina constitutions, that's reason enough to throw the verdict out and start over. It's worth noting that this appeal came after the defense's motion for a new trial had already failed. And that detail adds an extra layer to their argument, because now they're not just saying the trial was flawed, they're also challenging the system's response to those flaws. They're asking the state's highest court to overrule a lower court's finding that essentially said, yes, there was misconduct, but it wasn't enough. This isn't just a legal chess match, it's a referendum on the integrity of one of the most talked about trials in recent American history. And the stakes aren't just about Murdaugh's fate. They're about whether the public can trust the outcome of a case that played out more like a Netflix drama than a routine court proceeding. And if you want to understand the core of Alec Murdaugh's appeal, you have to strip away all the noise, the documentaries, the Dateline specials, the courtroom memes, and get down to the filing that hit the South Carolina Supreme Court in December 2024. It was 121 pages long, meticulous in tone, and surgical in intent. This wasn't a desperate shot in the dark. It was a calculated roadmap of exactly how and why Murdaugh's defense team believes his conviction wasn't just flawed, it was legally unsound. At the heart of the appeal is a name that's become almost as controversial as Murdaugh's: Rebecca Becky Hill, the court clerk, the woman who managed jury logistics during the trial. The same woman who, according to the defense, didn't just cross a line, she allegedly bulldozed through it. The defense claims that Hill's actions amounted to jury tampering, and they're not being subtle about it. They allege that during the trial, Hill told jurors not to be fooled by Murdaugh's testimony, that she made comments suggesting he was lying on the stand, that she encouraged jurors to deliberate quickly, possibly to meet media deadlines or for the sake of public optics, and perhaps most eyebrow-raising of all, they point to the fact that she published a book about the trial shortly after the verdict. A book that paints her as a small-town hero navigating the biggest case the Lowcountry had ever seen. The implication from the defense that she was playing to the cameras and possibly pushing the jury to do the same. But here's the kicker. The judge who oversaw the post-trial hearing, former South Carolina Chief Justice Jean Toll, didn't entirely dismiss these claims. In fact, she went on record saying that Becky Hill was not credible, that her conduct was highly inappropriate, that she appeared to have been influenced by the idea of fame. And yet Toll denied the motion for a new trial anyway. Her rationale was that, despite Hill's behavior, the defense hadn't proven that her actions actually influenced the jury's decision. In legal terms, that's the difference between misconduct and reversible misconduct. Murdaugh's lawyers weren't satisfied. In the December appeal, they doubled down. They argued that the very nature of Hill's alleged interference compromised the jury's independence. That a fair trial means more than just a clean verdict. It means a process that's untouched by outside influence. And if the court clerk herself was pushing the scale behind the scenes even slightly, that's not a fair trial. It's theater. But the appeal doesn't stop with Becky Hill. That's just the headline. The deeper content of the brief gets into what lawyers call cumulative error, meaning that even if each individual issue isn't enough to toss the verdict, the combined weight of them might be. Think of it like this. One leak in a boat isn't great, but a dozen small leaks? That's going to sink something. One of the biggest leaks the defense points to is the inclusion of Murdaugh's financial crimes during the murder trial. Now, Murdaugh has already admitted to stealing millions of dollars from clients and his former law firm. He's pleaded guilty in both state and federal court. But the question raised in the appeal is whether all of that should have been part of the murder trial at all. Judge Clifton Newman allowed prosecutors to present detailed testimony about Murdaugh's financial misdeeds. The prosecution argued it went to motive, that Murdaugh was in a financial death spiral and killed his wife and son to distract from the unraveling of his secret life. The defense, on the other hand, says that was pure character assassination. They argue that the financial testimony served to make the jury despise Murdaugh before they even got to the murder charges, that it painted him not just as flawed, but as monstrous, and that no fair jury could look past that avalanche of unrelated fraud to assess the murder evidence objectively. This isn't a new legal debate. Courts often have to decide when bad behavior is relevant and when it's just prejudicial. The defense argues that in this case, the scale tipped too far. That the jury got lost in tales of missing millions, opioid addiction, and betrayed friends, and that those details blurred the line between a motive theory and a smear campaign. There's also the issue of forensic evidence. The appeal challenges how certain evidence was presented and whether key details were misrepresented or overemphasized. This includes things like ballistics, matching shell casings to weapons, and digital forensics like cell phone data, placing Murdaugh near the crime scene. The defense claims that some of the expert testimony overstated certainty or leaned on methods that lacked scientific rigor. While these aren't headline-grabbing arguments, they're strategically important. Because if an appellate court finds that the jury was misled or misinformed by expert testimony, even in part, that opens the door to questioning the entire verdict. Another point raised in the appeal is the exclusion of defense witnesses. During the trial, Murdaugh's team attempted to call certain individuals to testify on his behalf, some about his character, others to refute prosecution timelines or evidence. According to the appeal, the court limited or outright blocked this testimony. The defense argues that this hamstrung their ability to present a complete narrative. They say jurors didn't get the full picture, and that's not how the system is supposed to work. There's also mention of how the media circus surrounding the case might have influenced proceedings. While the appeal doesn't hinge on this, it does suggest that the courtroom atmosphere was charged with pressure, attention, and spectacle. That's important context when paired with the Becky Hill allegations, as it paints a picture of a trial that was not just public, but potentially performative. At the core of all of this is one legal principle: structural fairness. The defense doesn't have to prove that Alec Murdaugh is innocent. They don't even have to prove that a different jury would have acquitted him. What they're arguing is that the structure of the trial, the foundation it was built on, was compromised, and that under the U.S. and South Carolina constitutions, that's reason enough to throw the verdict out and start over. It's worth noting that this appeal came after the defense's motion for a new trial had already failed, and that detail adds an extra layer to their argument. Because now they're not just saying the trial was flawed, they're also challenging the system's response to those flaws. They're asking the state's highest court to overrule a lower court's finding that essentially said, yes, there was misconduct, but it wasn't enough. This isn't just a legal chess match, it's a referendum on the integrity of one of the most talked about trials in recent American history. And the stakes aren't just about Murdaugh's fate, they're about whether the public can trust the outcome of a case that played out more like a Netflix drama than a routine court proceeding. It's strange to think that after everything, the trial, the verdict, the tearful testimonies, the clerk scandal, and the endless media frenzy, we're still in a waiting period. But that's exactly where the Alec Murdaugh case sits right now. In the legal world, this is the long inhale before the next swing of the pendulum. The ball's in the prosecution's court with their appeal response due by August 8th. After that, we move into the final stages of a process that could reshape not only the verdict, but the story that's been told about this case from day one. When that deadline hits, the South Carolina Attorney General's office will submit its full rebuttal to Murdaugh's appeal. That document, still unseen, will be their comprehensive answer to every allegation raised by the defense. Not just the claims of jury tampering, but the fights over forensic testimony, the inclusion of financial crimes, and the broader argument that Murdaugh's trial was compromised from the inside out. Once that response lands, Murdaugh's team will likely fire back with a reply brief, a short follow-up that hits back at whatever new points the state raises. That reply could come in September. And then we enter the final arena, oral arguments. Those arguments are likely to be scheduled for late 2025 or maybe early 2026, depending on how packed the state Supreme Court's calendar is. When they happen, both sides will get their shot to stand before the justices and make their case in real time. No more filings, no more footnotes, just lawyers on their feet answering tough questions, defending their logic, and trying to pull the court to their side. It's not a retrial. It's not about facts. It's about the process. Was it fair? Were rights violated? And did any of it, taken individually or together, cross the line from questionable into unconstitutional? And then comes the waiting game again. The court could issue a decision weeks later, or it could take months. There's no set timeline, no countdown clock. But when that opinion drops, it will land with weight. Because there are only a handful of possible outcomes, and each one has massive consequences. The first, and maybe the most straightforward, is that the court affirms the convictions. If the justices agree with the state, they could issue a ruling saying that the trial, warts and all, was fair enough to stand. No new trial, no remand, no relief. That would effectively shut the door on Murdaugh's direct appeal. At that point, if he wants to keep fighting, he'd have to go to federal court and argue that his constitutional rights were violated. That's a harder road, with stricter standards, and while not impossible, it's not a path that many defendants successfully walk. If that happens, Murdaugh's status becomes more or less frozen in time. He remains convicted of murdering his wife and son, serving back-to-back life sentences. With the state's highest court having signed off on the process, that would be the legal end of the murder case, at least in the state system. For most people, that would also be the public end of the narrative. Case closed, verdict upheld, story over. But the second possibility is very different. The court could decide to overturn the convictions. That's the nuclear option. It wouldn't mean Murdaugh walks out of prison the next day. He's still serving time for a laundry list of financial crimes, but it would wipe the murder verdict off the board. The slate would be clean, legally speaking, and the state would have to make a choice, try him again or drop the charges. And let's be honest, dropping the charges is highly unlikely. This case has been too big, too public, too defining for prosecutors to just walk away. If the court grants a new trial, the state would almost certainly proceed with a second round. That would mean new jury selection, new arguments, a new judge, especially since Judge Newman is retiring, and possibly a very different courtroom strategy. The retrial wouldn't be a rerun. It would be a reimagining shaped by the lessons learned the first time around and the legal boundaries redrawn by the Supreme Court's ruling. That kind of outcome would also reopen the floodgates in terms of public attention. The first trial was a media spectacle. The second would be an even bigger event because now the stakes wouldn't just be about guilt or innocence, they'd be about institutional accountability, about what went wrong the first time, about whether justice was delayed or denied, and about whether the system can actually self-correct in the most high profile of cases. Then there's the middle ground, the third option, a partial remand. This is where the court says, in effect, something here isn't quite right, but we're not throwing everything out. That could mean sending one or more issues back to the trial court for further hearings, maybe to re-examine the impact of a particular ruling, maybe to dig deeper into specific juror conduct, maybe to clarify a procedural question. It wouldn't undo the conviction right away, but it would keep the case open and potentially set the stage for a later reversal, depending on what those hearings reveal. So while the final ruling hasn't been written yet, what's already clear is this. No matter which way the court goes, the decision will define more than just one man's legal status. It will shape the legacy of the entire case, because this isn't just about whether Alec Murdaugh killed his wife and son. It's about what we believe the justice system should look like when the spotlight is blinding. It's about whether high-profile defendants can get a fair trial in a media-saturated environment, whether courtroom officials like clerks can be held to account when their behavior crosses ethical lines, and whether the courts are willing to admit, when necessary, that the outcome of a trial doesn't always mean the process was flawless. There's also the reputational side of this, which doesn't get talked about much in legal filings, but looms large in the public imagination. Because right now, Alec Murdaugh sits in prison with the label of double murderer. That's what most people know. That's what's burned into the headlines, the podcasts, the TV specials. But if that conviction is overturned, if a court says that the trial wasn't fair enough to stand, then the narrative changes. It doesn't mean Murdaugh becomes a sympathetic figure. The mountain of fraud charges still looms large, but it does open a door to reframing. From a cold-blooded killer to a man who may have been convicted in a courtroom where the process bent too far under pressure. That distinction matters not just to Murdaugh and his lawyers, but to the public and to every future case that finds itself in a similarly glaring spotlight. In the coming months, the justices of the South Carolina Supreme Court will quietly read their briefs, review the transcripts, and prepare to hear the final arguments. No cameras, no crowds, just the law as it was applied or misapplied in one of the most dramatic trials in recent history. And when they finally issue their decision, it won't just be the end of a legal process. It'll be the start of a new chapter. How we remember this case, how we talk about justice in high-stakes trials, and what gets etched into the record when the dust finally settles.
The mansion was pristine, gleaming marble floors, priceless art, not a speck of dust in sight. But beneath all that luxury, secrets, dark ones, the kind that send a chill down your spine when you realize someone's watching. And the housekeeper, she saw everything, the late night visitors, the missing jewelry, the glass of wine that was only half finished before she disappeared. Some say the husband was heartbroken. Others say he was just waiting for the insurance check to clear. But if she had just been prepared, if she had just known the patterns of these kinds of crimes, if she had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, where she could listen to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, ad-free, and before everyone else, she could have gotten out. Instead, well, let's just say her final paycheck is still sitting in the mailroom. Don't make the same mistake. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.